Hi, everyone, and welcome to the sixth episode of At Jerry Talks. We are delighted to have with us today Willard Mwemba, who is the head of the COMESA Competition Commission. Willard was before that the head of mergers for COMESA. And so this is the perfect person to have for us to discuss COMESA, mergers and competition law, which we'll be discussing today. So thank you so much, Willard, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jerry. It's always a pleasure to have me, much appreciated.
So Willard, I've known you for a very long time. We've dealt with each other on several transactions, but I don't know anything about you. I tried to look on the internet and there's very little information. So we normally start with a quick fire round just to let us know about yourself, what you've been doing, etc. So Willard, I know that you've been to Kenya many times. I've met you in Nairobi. You get to travel a lot with your work. What is your favorite destination in Eastern and Southern Africa?
It's a very interesting question, and quite difficult to pick one particular city because they all have their own unique and peculiar features that excite someone. So it would be very difficult to pick one, but under the circumstances and to attempt to answer your question, I would pick Cairo in Egypt. And why am I picking Cairo in Egypt? You've never been to Cairo?
Never.
It's quite a beautiful place. It's quite a beautiful place. And why do I pick it? It is one city that fascinates me with the fusion of modernity and medieval times. So you would find that their ancient features are very well preserved. So even as they are modernizing, it is a city that can take you thousands of years back in history, and you really appreciate that. So other cities are probably that fusion of modernity and medieval times, as I've said, probably is one thing we're missing out because the rest of most of the other cities, the focus is just on modernizing, not trying to preserve the historical our village settings. For example, I'll talk about my country, Zambia. Those village settings that we had, traditional ancient way of living and what, they are slowly erasing them, going for modernity. And we think that's the best thing to do. But it's also important to preserve some history and know where you're coming from. So that fascinates me about Egypt, I think, Cairo to be specific.
Thank you for that, Willard. Bringing us to the modernization that you're talking about and bringing us to a competition law, which is a modern day concept. How did you get into competition? Why competition law? What drew you to that field of law?
At personal level?
Yes, at a personal level.
Okay, no, at personal level, I'd be very honest with you that it was somehow accidental and by chance. So when we were in our final year at the University of Zambia, I remember our lecturer came and said, I've seen some adverts at the Zambia Competition Commission. Then it was called Competition and Consumer Protection Commission now. So it was called Zambia Competition Commission then. So he came and told us that there are some adverts who are just about to graduate then, or just about to write our final exams. So he said, there are some adverts I've seen at the Zambia Competition Commission. So those who feel like applying, they should apply. So then we asked him a question, but we are not yet graduates. We don't even have those certificates and what. So how are they going to pick us? So he says, oh no, they are also looking for interns. So make your application, take it there, and who knows, you may be picked as an intern. So yeah, you know, when you're about to leave school and university, you're excited to get jobs and what. So I did apply as an intern after I finished my university, but before the graduation. I was lucky, I was picked. As I said, I naturally developed this affection for competition law. Read a lot even as I was an intern on it, and probably made an impact even as an intern. So when they advertised for substantive position of a junior economist at the commission, then I pushed in my application, and they did not waste time to picking me as a substantive junior economist. Then so I would want to believe that probably I'd impress them with what I had done as an intern. And that's how I began the journey of competition law to where we are today. The rest is history.
I guess the rest is history, Willard, because you've done amazingly well. You also went to do a master's at King's College on European competition law, and your PhD thesis, which is online actually, and I had a chance to skim it, is on supranational competition authorities. Tell me, so it seems like a deliberate pattern of understanding and specializing in competition law. What is your aim for a supranational African competition regime? And then secondly, how has the study of European competition law affected your understanding of competition law, or how it should work for us in Africa?
Okay, no, that's a good question. To start with, if you're looking at the European competition law and competition law in Africa, generally, the principles are the same, okay? Where we differ, I think, is in the application of those principles of competition law in terms of the appreciation and giving the due regard and importance of the impact that the competition law can bring in our markets. So I would be very frank to tell you that in terms of principles and the general understanding of competition law, I think we are just exactly the same. We may differ here and there slightly in procedure, which is not unusual. But the difference, substantive difference, is the importance and appreciation we attach to this subject of competition law here compared to them. I think for them, there's this deep understanding and appreciation that the competition law, properly implemented and enforced, can have a substantial effect on the shaping of the economy of their region here or there, which I think we need to do more here in terms of imparting that understanding and appreciation. You'll find that even at national level, generally in most of our member states, competition law is not so much of a priority, even by the policymakers in government. Sometimes it's given a little piece of the national cake, signifying how they do not attach much importance to that subject as they would attach to other similar important subjects. Yes, so I think that's the main difference I would have seen between competition law in Europe and competition law in Africa, not just Africa, less developed countries generally.
Okay. Let's talk about then the second question I wanted to ask, which is on supranational competition regimes and authorities. Do you think that's the way forward for Africa? Is that what you would like to see?
Absolutely. That is the way forward for Africa. And the answer is very simple. You agree with me, Njeri, that I'm not against any undertakings, but it is a fact that anti-competitive practices are there in the market. So you agree with me that where we have fragmented laws at national level, there is a possibility that this certain conduct by undertakings may be lawful in individual member states, but cumulatively may be unlawful. So it becomes easy for undertakings sometimes to evade the law as a result of those fragmented, uncoordinated, and incoherent approaches to competition law enforcement. Yeah, so when we have these supranational competition authorities, it does help. So in terms of the supranational competition authority at continental level, I think that is something that would be good. What we should be discussing are the modalities under which it would be implemented, whether it would be the actual enforcement modality, or it would be some kind of cooperation amongst the competition authorities at regional level in Africa, including those of national competition authorities. That one may be discussed at a later stage when we are implementing the actual authority. But what we may state here is that indeed it would be important to have such a body to superintend competition law enforcement in Africa. Yeah. The downturn to that also is that we may want to be very careful not to defeat the very same objective that we have in mind to create these supranational competition authorities. So you find that now regions, we have the EAC, we have COMESA, we have SADC, we have ECOWAS, we have CEMAC, and then there's a lot of overlapping membership, especially if you look at SADC, EAC, and COMESA. almost all the partner states of EAC, with the exception of Tanzania and South Sudan, I think, the rest of them are members of COMESA. So what happens now? Are we not going back to the same challenge we are trying to, for example, in terms of reducing the burden on the undertakings conducting business in COMESA or in these regions? Are we not then still adding on to the burden? Because if a transaction affects EAC and it also affects COMESA, are we not saying currently under the framework that they'll still need to notify the EAC and notify COMESA? So those are some of the things, even as we are creating these regional authorities, that we should be having in mind.
Completely understood on that, Willard, and I agree with you. Because we're going to be focusing on measures for this discussion, I wanted us to focus on the point that you made about European competition law and the principles applying to being the same or applying to us in Africa as well. Given that Europe is so developed and the African continent is in general, do you think we should still apply the same principles to a developing nation rather than the European nations which are already developed?
Well, personally, I think yes, because those principles are very general. The specifics of how we apply them is where we may differ. So, for example, there are principles of thresholds. Should we apply the thresholds exactly as they apply in Europe? The definite answer is no. The European economy is by far bigger than ours. So just getting those thresholds and implementing them here in their format would not apply. But the reasoning behind having thresholds, though, that principle, we can apply it here and adapt it to our own peculiar situations. So in terms of the general principles, Njeri, my general answer, subject to few exemptions, my general answer is that yes, they should apply, but what should differ is the way we apply them. So we should adopt and adapt them to our situation, yes.
Okay, cool. So that answers my first question. And then secondly, we've now touched on the difference between regional bodies and then, overarching bodies and the competing interests that they have. So correct, EAC, COMESA, national bodies themselves or local bodies, CIMAC, and then SADC, etc. Many people do not understand how these interlink, why they should apply to each body separately, and what is the arrangements that you have between the local, national, and then even overarching bodies to ensure that everyone's interests are covered? Is that still something that you're grappling with?
Between regional bodies, frankly, yes. Between regional bodies, so for example, COMESA and the EAC, yes. And I'll give an answer, the reason for that. Between us, COMESA, and the national competition authorities in COMESA, no. I think that is something that we've worked on quite perfectly. And yeah. You are from Kenya, Njeri, so you will recall the issues with Kenya, and I think we'll discuss that later as I expound on this. But yes, coming back to between regional bodies, so for example, EAC and COMESA, that is something in the current state that brings concern, that by virtue of their law and by virtue of our laws, and as long as these laws remain the same, then they will have jurisdiction on transactions that affect the EAC, even if they overlap with those transactions affecting COMESA, because that's what their law states. That's what our law states. So we shouldn't only, as competition authorities, be looking at businesses complying with the laws, businesses not being engaged in anti-competitive practices, the very same way we want to clean the market from anti-competitive practices by businesses, should be the very same way we should be in the forefront to create an environment that reduces the burden on the businesses to comply with our laws, the cost of compliance and everything. I'll be very quick to tell you that, of course, EAC authority is in its nascent stages, and we are discussing those issues, trying to see how we can go around our legal frameworks, but to address that concern.
Okay, good. when we do the podcast, it's really for people to gain an understanding and for collaboration to be able to occur. What is a merger? And tell us why a merger is important in the context of businesses in Africa and commerce specifically.
So a merger in simple terms is simply the coming together of two or more undertakings that previously were operating independently, that previously were making decisions independently, that previously were mindful of the decisions, the commercial decisions being made by the other on the market, and to adjust themselves to ensure that those decisions do not impact on them negatively to exit the market. And that's what competition is. But okay, once those undertakings that were behaving like that before this creature we call a merger come together, and they are no longer mindful of those independent commercial decisions by the other, then a merger would have been established in simple terms.
Okay. So you've explained that it's a combination of two parties who have been aware of each other in the market. Good. But there are several criteria for determining when a merger has occurred. And I want us to go into that so that we can tell the public what it is that they should be mindful of in the context of an application for or a notification for clearance for their mergers. What is that, Willard?
So the first thing to look at is the basics that we've already talked about. So once you come to an understanding that those basics of bringing two or more firms that were independent previously is a merger, the next thing you ask yourself is it a merger within the context of the commercial competition regulations? So you would have first of all to establish whether those parties or those undertakings to a merger have operations in two or more member states. So if they do not operate in two or more member states, then that transaction does not qualify to be a merger within the context of commercial competition regulations. But where it is clear and established that the parties to the transaction operate in two or more member states, then you begin to have an understanding that this is a transaction that may require the COMESA notification. But it doesn't end there. Yeah. So once you say, well, we can clearly establish that we operate in Kenya, Zambia, Malawi, and Egypt, for example. So clearly we operate in a number of COMESA member states. That should give you an indication that it may be a transaction I need to take to the commission for notification. Because if I don't do that, maybe I may be fined for not complying with the regulations. But it doesn't end there, Anjeri. Even when you're saying I heard you hinted that people are complaining that we hinder business and we are anti-competitive ourselves. Not necessarily. In fact, not necessarily. Completely, that is not true. Why? Because even certain transactions like that become majors that operate in two or more member states are not notifiable automatically at that stage of taking out the criteria that we look at. So the next thing would be to look at whether you've met what we call the major notification thresholds. And the reason we came up with thresholds is to ensure that small, insignificant transactions that are not likely to raise competition concerns are not looked at by ourselves. So we can tell them, please go free, go and do whatever you want. We think your issues will not raise competition concerns. So we let them off the hook. So it's something that, Njeri, you should be commending the commission for instead of castigating us. So anyway, so what we do then, even after it's established that the parties operate in two or more member states, we need now to establish whether they meet the quantitative thresholds. So the combination of turnover or assets of those parties, or whichever will be higher, should not be below $50 million in the common market. So it should be $50 million or more. So if the combination of their turnover and assets in the common market is less than $50 million, which pretty is quite a lot of say high figure
and
value. Yeah, looking at our economies again, our economy, yes. COMESA wide, the whole GDP of COMESA is smaller than the GDP of Belgium, Belgium is one of the smallest economies in Europe. So you understand the size of the economies we're talking about. So 50 million is quite a lot. Okay. But then it doesn't end there. Once you meet the 50 million, we're saying, well, it may be the case that you've met the 50 million, but the transaction may still not raise concern with us. We would now want to look at the individual parties to that transaction. What significance will the merging of these two or three companies bring to the common market in terms of anti-competitive concerns? So if it is the case that, it should be the case that at least two of each of the parties to that transaction should not derive less than 10 million. So if it is found that one of them derives less than 10 million turnover or assets in the common market, then even if they in combination they derive 250 million, 1 billion US dollars in the common market, that is a transaction we'll consider to be insignificant, and we'll still tell the parties, okay, please, you've met the 50 million, you have 1 billion turnover combined in COMESA, but this transaction is still insignificant. And then it doesn't end there, because we are so generous in Jerry. We are so generous and so practical. We just want to look at transactions that are significant in COMESA. We would say, well, we've seen we've met the 50 million combined threshold requirement. You've met the 10 million individual threshold requirement. But if it is the case that the parties to that transaction, or the parties to that transaction, they each derive more than two-thirds of their assets or turnover, whichever is higher, in one and the same member state. So, for example, it is a merger between DHL and which is that other courier company? I've forgotten it. There's DHL. Which is the other one?
FedEx.
I had FedEx in my mind. Yeah. So there's a merger between DHL and FedEx. But when we do our computations of their turnover and assets, we come to the conclusion that even if they are in all member states, more than 66% of their turnover, both of them, is just in Kenya. We conclude that that transaction will raise significant competition concerns in Kenya, not in the common market. So we will tell them this transaction is not notifiable, but you may wish to get in touch with the Kenyan Competition Authority in case they would be of the view that the transaction should be reviewed there. So in a nutshell, Njeri, the criteria we've just laid down here is, once it is met, what will conclude or establish that there is a major transaction to be notified with the Commercial Competition Commission.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that explanation, Willard. And I think it's a very useful one for all of the listeners. You recently clarified what operating in two or more member states means. And I think there's been a lot of, yes, misunderstanding. What does that mean?
So even on that one, I'll try to break it down in very, very simple terms as well, so that none of us is lost. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'll start by breaking down what we mean by operate. So what we mean by operate is that this particular undertaking or undertakings should derive some turnover in the common market. Okay? So by deriving turnover, it may be by virtue of sales, direct sales into the common market, exports into the common markets that give revenue to this company that is not domiciled in the common market. Okay. So if we are on the same page on that one, then I'll now move on to operate under the guidelines as it was put. I think it is section 3.9 of the guidelines, if I'm not mistaken.
Threshold of $5 million.
Exactly. So between you and I, we will agree that by implication, that was a threshold. But because it was a threshold that was benefiting you lawyers, you found no reason to say the commission is breaking the law. This is a threshold and the threshold is zero. So because it benefited everyone, everyone was quiet. But that is a subject for another day. So we did not call it a threshold for obvious reasons that we were going to be out-traverse the law. But we defined the word operate to mean 5 million in the common market. So the guidelines, Njeri, as you've read our commercial competition law, and like in Kenya, for example, where guidelines would have some binding.
Yes.
MESA, the guidelines are not binding. They just give us some direction on how we address certain matters. So we needed to still put our house in order. In March 2015, the section 3.9 of the guideline became now void. What motivated the practice note is that we had a lot of questions in relation to the thresholds over and over, and we gave answers to individual questions as such. And these questions were not dying. So we realized that we needed to adopt a certain approach that will broadcast the message widely to everyone once and for all.
Okay. I think you've pointed out at the moment the rules and the regulations and the guidelines are in very separate documents. Is there any plan to amalgamate it into one consolidated version so that everyone is on the same page? The guidelines, I guess, can remain because they're non-binding, but certainly the rules and the regulations, do they need to be separate?
I believe so. They need to be separate from a substantive point of view, from an approach or presentation point of view. They can be in the same book. And I think that's what we've done that actually not long ago. But from a substantive point of view, they need to remain separate. Why? Because the rules actually simply give effect to the regulations. So it may be... Kenya is a common law country, right?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So in most common law countries, the equivalent of the regulations would be what you call the act.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The equivalent of the rules may what we call the regulations at national level in common law countries at least. So the regulations in Kenya, for example, simply give effect to the act. Effect in terms of operationalizing them.
Yes.
What is operate? So the rules will now explain what operate means. Things like that. So the act, which is the regulations in our case, will define certain terms and address certain issues broadly. The rules, which are your regulations in your case, will then give effect and guidance on how you operate the regulations or the act in your case. So in my view, they should remain separate. And it also just tries to bring in consistency and certainty in that the parties yourselves will have a common understanding with us. That does not stop you from challenging us when you feel like this is not how the rules and the regulations should be interpreted. So you have all the rights to challenge the guidelines, actually.
One of the things that the authority can be congratulated on is always being very, very responsive. So I can commend you on that.
Thank you so much for those warm words.
Don't take it as a criticism. What I think it is that a lot of us are grappling with the fact that making a competition application is not a simple task. It requires a lot of information and it's expensive. So let's talk about the criticisms of the authority. Let's talk about the fees. A lot of people are, when they see that the fees is 200,000, the transaction, the legal fees are also 200,000. How are they ever going to pull off the merger?
It's an interesting question, Injeri, because we'll start by helping the parties by reducing the legal fees from 200,000. Even before we reduce the notification fee. So Njeri and your colleagues in the legal field should help the clients by reducing the legal fees that you charge them.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Now, coming to the 200,000, you see, initially the major notification fees were at 500,000, Njeri.
Yes.
And you will recall that it was at that time that I'd become so famous, probably even more famous than Brad Pitt. I think my name was all over because of the, not for good reasons, by the way, because of the 500, because I was the one picking up all those calls and justifying that this is what the law says and the law is the law. I was so adamant, the law is the law. And so I was very famous for very... infamous reasons. So, so just to give it context, the 500,000, indeed, we listened to the cries of the public and we agreed in course that it was high. But look, Even as we were reducing, we had to do some work and made some comparisons. Okay, I have that work even now. It should be public work now because we've already moved past that. I can share with you to just show you permutations we were making. We looked at the 500,000 that parties were paying here, okay, mm-hmm. and looked at the notification fees they would have paid at national level if the commercial competition regulations were not in force. So when we looked at that injury, we came to the conclusion that, look, parties are still a little bit, of course, it's case by case in certain circumstances, no? But generally, they were a little bit more better with their COMESA application at $500,000 than attempting to go to each of the individual member states and make individual applications. Mm-hmm. And in our work, we still compared, not just in Africa. We went to Italy, we went to Britain, we went to the United States of America and looked at some of their notification fees.
Willard, we are not in Europe.
We are not in Europe.
Why wasn't an approach favored where it's based on the turnover of the companies rather than a blanket fee? And also, it could be by industry. You know, there's some industries that are on the up and up. Mining and etc. is much more developed. There are different approaches to how the fees could be paid, isn't it?
No, you are right. And on that one, I'll not disagree with you when you say no, but we are not in Europe. Absolutely. But we needed to make some comparisons for us to come up with some figure that is meaningful. Okay. So we ended up anyway reducing it to $200,000, which was more than 60% reduction from what it was. I think we should be commended for that. But I still see that there are still concerns that even the 200,000 is high. Probably at the right time, such figures may be revised as well. But just to say that from 500 to 200, sorry?
I have your commitment on the reduction. Excellent.
We'll see about that injury. Actually, the blanket fee injury would have been to your disadvantage, to tell you the truth. Because this filing fee, the one based on turnover, is a relative fee. It depends on how much turnover you derive. So the lower the turnover, the lower the fee. The higher the turnover, the higher the fee. So when you talk about mining, for example, those guys who have a lot more money, it is almost always the case that they will pay the maximum. When you talk about startups and those companies that whose turnovers is very minimal, usually they may not even notify their transaction to the commission, because we are saying the notification fee is 0.1% of your turnover or assets, whichever is higher. And if your turnover or asset, whichever is higher, is less than 50 million in the common market, your transaction may not even be notified. So it does then mean that in any circumstance, the minimum the commission may charge is $50,000 minimum. If you cannot meet the $50,000 notification fee, it means your transaction is not even notifiable in the first place.
Yeah.
So the turnover one, based on the relative amount, actually takes into account those concerns that the smaller the company, the lesser the fees it pays, probably it may not even need to be notified in the first place. If it was blanket, it would have been detrimental to smaller companies, probably advantageous to the bigger companies.
Understood. And thank you for that clarification, Willard. But I'm glad.
I hope you will not slap me by saying then we'll consider you to be too small for us.
No. Actually, what I was going to say is I'm glad I've got your assurance that you're going to consider lowering the fees. So that's good for me. The other thing that I wanted to touch on is the criticism that, you know, sometimes when you're making the decisions, you're very reliant on what the local regulator's view is and not enough on independent assessment of the claim or the application yourself. What do you say to that, Willard?
It's not correct. It's not true. Far from the truth. Our interaction with the national competition authorities is consultative, okay? And what they submit to us are their views on the transaction. What informs the final decision is ours. So we may agree with their views based on our own assessments, or we may disagree with them. So I'll tell you that there have been instances where competition authorities have submitted concerns to us and requested that that should be the decision, and we've rejected. I would call it an intelligence gathering approach. Even those who work in the government intelligence divisions, that's the approach they use. Sometimes don't fear so much. They plant, don't be scared. They would plant one of theirs in your institution, and you never know that is an intelligent intelligence official. So it's the same process even with us. So it is just for information gathering, intelligence gathering, but we do make and undertake our own assessment.
Okay, let's talk about then the people who don't make notifications and what you've done about enforcement. At the moment, is there really, first of all, are there penalties for not applying? Have you sanctioned people for not doing that? And is that in the public? Also, if in terms of the conditions that you put for mergers, what have you done about making sure that the mergers conditions are adhered to? Because we get the approval, we have conditions, we have compliance requirements. What actually happens if you don't comply or if you don't make an application?
Thank you, Jerry. So on the first question, when you say what happens if you've not notified the transaction to the commission, is that the question?
Yes, but I don't mean in accordance with the regulations. I mean it, practically speaking, because I don't think people necessarily understand that there are ramifications for this, or that you can come after them, or that you have come after parties who have not notified.
Okay, so that's a good question. Frankly, I'm not aware of a party that has engaged in a merger and they've not just notified it with the commission. I'm not aware of that yet. It may be there in the market, but it's not something that we are aware of. If we became aware, there would be a hefty fine of maximum. I hope a lot of people are listening to me. That one I can assure them that the maximum would be 10% of their annual turnover in the common market, because it would have been a blatant disregard of what the law says. So we've never come across that situation yet. The situation we've come across probably is on the submission of the notification beyond the 30 days of making a decision that the regulations talk about. So that one we've come across, people have come and notified a transaction whose decision to merge took place after the expiration of the 30 days, which is punishable as well. But the answer to that is that we've not yet punished anyone. We've cautioned people. So in the decision, we've cautioned. Remember, punishing is not, the law says a maximum of 10%. So it can be 9%, it can be 1%, it can even be a caution. Okay. Yeah. So we've given cautionary notes in the past to those who've done that. And of course, they've tried to give an explanation of why that happened. That said, Injury, as long as the law remains in its current form, we are changing our approach. Number one, that we will be fining the period of making a notification. So even where they would have notified, if they did not make it within the time allowed for by the regulations, we will be fining. Now that is the approach. But then we also made it easy for the parties to comply with that 30-day period by stating that, look, in our guideline, we refer to complete and incomplete notifications. So if you can't manage to complete your notification within 30 days, at least engage us, at least talk about the transaction with us, at least send an email and state in this process, we'll be sending in the notification soon. Because that process, if we read it together with our guidelines, would have taken it to be the beginning of the process, which is subject to completion at a reasonable time thereafter.
Yeah, you did specify and state that, I think in some notice that I saw in regard to dealing with the COVID pandemic and amending the timelines accordingly. So that was welcome. What other measures? That another criticism, you know, I have the opportunity, so I need to take it, is that you have not done more apart from the timelines to deal with parties in competition or in mergers during this pandemic. Given that the pandemic is still ongoing a year later, what are your plans?
You are free to bring all those criticisms and read. So we don't shoot the messenger, no. So the messenger is just telling us what is happening there. So that is in order. But I would just want to understand you a little bit more. What would be in the minds of our stakeholders, our clients? What is it that they would love us to see? And why I say this is that we cannot really convince and compel the emerging parties in what form the measure should take as a result of the pandemic, or even encouraging them to engage in measures so that they evade the effects of the pandemic by coming together. So that would be completely be the part to the party's discretion to do that. What we can do is to try to relax the approach to major regulations, as we've done in that practice, not for example relaxing the time period, and also where they submit incomplete information, we've also now undertaking a relaxed approach in that we'll get back to them and tell them to submit complete information as long as it was not negligently done. So instead of fining them for submission of incomplete information, which is punishable as well, we've tried to relax that in the COVID period, because we know the challenges that parties, including ourselves, are facing in gathering information. So our view in Jeri was that we could only help the parties to the extent permissible within the law. We can interpret the law expansively, relax certain procedures. But in terms of, so I'm not so sure, that's why I'm asking, what would be in the minds of the parties?
You could reduce or cancel the fees for an application, for example. There's other things that you could do, for example, boosting certain industries and relaxing the requirement to notify in those industries and catch up later after COVID. So for example, pharmaceuticals, transportation, just maybe easing of restrictions during the COVID pandemic to encourage parties to work together so that we can beat it together.
No, that is very true. You bring another important aspect which I'll address soon, but that is very pertinent. In terms of reducing or scrapping the fee, Jeri, my answer would be as it was in 2013 and 2014 for now. The law is the law, and anything done contrary to that would mean the commission itself is breaking the law. So a little bit unfortunate on that, but I think you've moved a little bit beyond measures when you say, can competition authorities allow undertakings to work together somehow in this pandemic period, which may be to the advantage of all of us as human beings who are being ravaged by this strange animal called COVID. Yes, that is acceptable. And it's not just here in COMESA. I've seen similar approaches even in Europe. I know you would want to say Europe is a different market, but we see those things. Here in COMESA, actually, it's not just at the COMESA Competition Commission. There is even some kind of procedures and I don't want to call them rules because we confuse them with the binding rules. But they are kind of procedures and operations manuals at the COMESA Secretariat where those things have been addressed, where companies are encouraged to come together and see how they can enhance their efficiencies to deliver certain goods and services during this pandemic. That said, companies should still be very cautious not to dwell and delve into those issues that may be blatant competition law violations in the name of COVID. Fixing prices, there's nothing that would come out that would be good out of fixing prices. Market allocation, you just take Kenya or never come to Zambia, let's not compete. There is nothing good that will ever come out of that. So to avoid that injury, what the companies can do, because they will be, and there is a lot of uncertainty then, to say we've been allowed to work together, but what is it that we can do together that will not find us what will not put us in problems? What they can do is to approach the commission, either through comfort letters, if it is through measures, or through applications for authorizations and exemptions under Article 20, if it is through other agreements, and then we'll be able to guide.
Okay.
Or even just having a chat. We always are not formal here in Jeri. Even just having a chat as we are having, we will still guide them.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things I keep saying, anyone who knows you or knows the commission, you guys are very approachable and always willing to listen, and even very responsive on email. So very much appreciated, Willard. Now that you're the head of the CCC and not just in mergers, what are your plans, Willard, looking to the future? And will we miss you in the merger space, or will you still be very active?
I find that question to be interesting, very interesting. First of all, it's humbling to me, and wholeheartedly to see that I've been of great service and contribution to the clients there, from all the feedback that you guys have given me, from all the support indeed that you guys have given me. So that is very humbling to see that somehow people may miss you. Okay, if you disappear and no one misses you, I think it's a little bit disheartening. So so it's quite humbling. Yeah, as I stated earlier, I developed this affection for competition law quite early in my life, at a tender age, and I've loved competition law, I've lived competition law, I've breathed competition law. So the problem of getting to a higher position, as you've put it, you begin to get divorced from the substance to more of administration. So it is something that is unfortunate if you look at it from that angle. However, it will not be unusual and strange in Njeri to find that I am actually the one reviewing a certain case that I would feel I would be intellectually stimulated to review. So it may not be a complete goodbye. It may be the case that one of your transactions, I would just choose to review it myself and you deal with me directly. So it's not a complete goodbye, no.
Yeah, thank you so much, Willard. I wish you all the best in, you know, the supranational regional body, which I'm sure you will be heading in less than 5 years' time when we think
about
it.
Thanks for the blessings.
And thank you very much for your time, Willard. It's been amazing for us to listen to you and also to engage on very difficult topics, which people need clarity on. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Njeri. Always a pleasure. At the Commission here, we have a motto that we are available 24/7 whenever you need some clarification, unless the tone on my emails on the phone does not ring, I'm sleeping, then I'll fail to pick it. But as long as I see it, even at 1 a.m. would respond.
And so that's please, the truth. I feel it myself.
Exactly. So let's continue interacting. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, everyone. It's been Dr. Willard Mwemba, head of the CCC now, leaving mergers and effectively the head of the Comesa Competition Commission. Thanks for listening to us, and see you next month.